Well, a lot of really interesting things have been said here already today, and that, of course, has changed. Maybe want to scribble down all kinds of different things I want to say now from what I originally planned to say, but mainly, I love Germano's notion of a train going from nowhere to nowhere, because this whole sense of context is clearly one of the things that has been emerging today as a crucial theme, collision of perspectives and context. And Rob raised a question about where the truth is, which is obviously a very important thing for us to address in this body of work. I've heard Ilya say he often feels like he's walking in a dream in the work. And I think that I want to talk a little bit about the context for what I've done and then come back to some of the things that he said at the end. But there's some underlying premises here that maybe I should be very forthright about. One of them is that I really believe that every artist's subject matter is ultimately reality, that an artist is dealing with the reality of their precise moment and trying to make it cohere in some form that's acceptable to them. And one of the things that we're learning about reality today, and one of the things that I think has been brought up by all the things that have been discussed already this morning, is this question of displacement and collision of perspectives and complexity of what that reality really is. So in a sense, everything that's been said has, of course, also changed the context of what I thought I would be saying. And at the end, it's changed the meaning because I think I want to take a familiar story in some respects, a story that all of you may know in terms of the details of this history, but also the context and the forum, in a sense, have changed its meaning. Something I tried to raise in inarticulate form this morning was that the forum itself becomes the meaning, and that internationalizes it in a very interesting way. So let me come back to the kind of very specific, and I'm going to start in a very specific place. You're looking at a slide of the approach to the boat of my life as it was installed at the Cranford Art Museum at the University of Illinois. And we'll walk into that with a few slides here. But as a viewer of any of the Kabakov's installations, you're forced to alter your protocols of looking. And in this work of 1993, you really can't see much of anything just kind of walking through it. So I guess it's going the right way. You really you can't just rush through, or we're used to moving quickly in modern life, but you really have to slow down. And you've got to look at details. You enter through the fence, you don't know what's behind it. You come upon this huge, extraordinary wooden boat. You climb up on the deck, and you're seeing an overview here with all these moving boxes filled with things. You come up onto the deck, and you walk through this crowded space with the moving boxes. And then on the top of the moving boxes, you find these cardboards with sheets with things glued down to it. So you have to slow down, and you have to linger over the arbitrariness of the juxtapositions of a bent nail, an old snapshot, a crumbled candy wrapper, with the fragmentary entries from Kabakov's autobiography, which are the heart of this installation. He's glued hundreds of these tiny objects down to cardboard sheets and pinned the sparse lines of autobiographical text, typed rather unevenly on little sheets of paper. He's pinned these down next to the little objects. And these sheets are then, as you see, set on top of these open moving boxes, which are filled with old clothes and toys and shoes and the like. The autobiography entries themselves read like this, just to give you two examples. Winter, 1947. Mother brings me borscht, the second course, and fruit compote to school at night. I eat it all in the cloakroom. My classmates are passing by. Or March 1953, the death of Stalin. I'm walking crushed to death in the lines of thousands of people flattened against the wall. They're hurried quickly past the coffin. The feeling in the air is one of cosmic catastrophe. What will happen? In installations like The Boat of My Life or the Man Who Never Threw Anything Away, I'm sorry, I don't have a slide of this, but which is on permanent exhibition in Oslo, 1988. It's as though these slight things, these fragments of our experience, casually picked up, now displayed, have called up the emotionally charged vignettes of memory that are indexed to them. But even with the autobiography, these sparse lines are so fragmentary as to function like abstract forms, almost like a splash of color, a gesture of the brush in painting. And one of the most persistent features, to my view, in the art of Ilya Kabakov is his transfiguration of the smallest details of daily life into the conveyors of extravagantly poignant narratives. In these imaginative tales, seemingly evoked by the most prosaic artifacts, Kabakov casts light on life's ironies, its moments of tragic self-confinement and pathos, but also its spirituality and the exhilarating liberation that we find in the act of imagination itself. In fact, Kabakov's idea of total installation is, I think, founded on this kind of epiphany in a teacup. Imagine if, like the man who never threw anything away, you could see in every morsel of trash and each cast-off piece of string or bent paperclip the hypertrophied record of deeply stirring vignettes from memory, from a life lived or hoped or feared. Would you throw those things away? This artist's work is the story of the human condition, divined from the tiniest fragment found by happenstance at your feet. Kabakov's work is inherently social and interactive. In his paintings, as early as the 60s, he often included simple written narratives or conversations. Oops, I'm going backwards, I'm sorry. This is the painting I've done in the 80s, started in 81, I guess finished in 88. There is still a woman who has a cross written on it, which is hard to read, especially in the slide. Zara Samsonovna Konunyans, it says, that she's quoted there, and it says, "There is a woman in a blue knitted jacket behind me." And then the other passage is, "Yakub Petrovich Krasansky, we will bring two more boxes and that's all, there's nothing else downstairs." Got a number of conversations going on here. Sometimes he juxtaposed the text with images or real objects fixed to the surface, and these objects stand emblematically for whole scenarios in which these interactions took place. A tin cup, for example, may recall the totality of the Soviet communal kitchen. In the 1970-71 painting that Matthew showed this morning, the responses of the experimental group, Kabakov creates a critical discourse within the painting itself, between found objects applied to the blank surface, the toy train that we talked about, a nail, a coat hanger on another nail, and on the other hand, the composition, the text of an imagined conversation about the content of the work. Kabakov remarked that, he said, the game consisted in showing on the same surface the picture itself and the thoughts of the viewers about it. Beginning in 1970, Kabakov invented characters, as you all know, told their stories in albums, really the perfect vehicle for an unofficial artist who was not permitted to be exhibited in public, and for the life of a person living in a society that requires a radical separation between public expression and private feeling. The very first of these albums concerns Sitting in the Closet Primakov, one of my favorite characters, a character who retreated into the dark for half a year as a child so that he could only imagine what went on outside from the sounds coming through the wall. The first 8 pages of illustrations accompanying the text in this album are merely black squares with yellow text blocks. And it's a kind of sly, implied, ironic explanation for Malevich's black square. With age, Primakov became more eccentric and incoherent. Again, quoting Kabakov, as he writes in his narration, he that is Primakov, pronounced only nonsensical words. In a series of drawings entitled In the Apartment from the late 60s, Kabakov deliberately misidentified simple objects from the apartment in the text key that's below, an apt aesthetic metaphor for the common Soviet disjunction of public and private mental space. Then in the album, Anna Petrovna Has a Dream, there's a key at the bottom of each page identifying totally abstract forms, little circles, as the souls of specified individuals or things. Gavrikov formalized the complex intertwining of real feelings, private thoughts, imagination, and the survivor's dissimulation that was, I think, required in Soviet life and today increasingly in an ever more conformist America by displacing all of this onto a net of commentaries, as Gavrikov wrote. These were not my commentaries, although, of course, I wrote them with my own hand, but mentally, internally, it was as though these originated from others. They were, in the very precise sense, others' voices. Gavrikov and many of his friends were trained as artists in the 50s and joined the official artists' union. They weren't heroic revolutionaries trying to overthrow the system with their art. They kept out of sight, doing their unofficial work out of the public eye to satisfy themselves. Gavrikov had an official life as an illustrator of children's books, and since he was a professional artist, he could have a studio and make his art, the art he made really for himself, I think, without arousing suspicion. By the mid-60s, perhaps a dozen small groups of unofficial artists existed in Moscow, and all of them, I think, knew one another. The groups included poets and musicians and intellectuals. But again, he explained, but everyone knew everybody else, because they all shared the same fate, like a family which is in a bomb shelter. Everyone is sitting on his own suitcase, but they are all together in the same basement. This explains the unbelievable friendly relations and the ideal, so to speak, idealistic relationships toward one another of all the participants' residents in this basement. We were all united by the same fate and the danger that we would all be destroyed. It could happen any day. In the official parlance, with which everyone was compelled to agree, Russia was the workers' paradise, and in the same way as socialist realism, the official style portrayed a world that didn't exist, reinforcing the disconnectedness of social life and inner life in the Soviet Union that became even worse with the fall of Khrushchev in 1964. Again, Gavrikov, daily you felt an almost unbelievable threat. All the conversations were about who was detained, what was confiscated from whom, who was summoned, whose place was searched, what was taken, who could be arrested tomorrow or in the nearest future. Everyone understood that the life of each person, not only his work, but he himself, could be wiped from the face of the earth. For what? When Gavrikov talked of his inner voices colliding, concealing each other, drowning out one another without any particular succession or connection, almost a howl, a tangled screaming content, his words suggest the well of anxiety out of which this collection of surrogate personas evolved. It is striking that The Boat of My Life, which deals almost dispassionately with the autobiography that lies behind this, but that very detachment is part of the survivor's strategy. If this disjunction between word and signification, image and idea, is rooted in the terror and lies of the Soviet past, its use of interchangeable characters appropriated by the artist to express his own most intimate feelings is also a kind of postmodern and post-utopian detachment that is very much of our moment, again, I think especially in America today. Gavrikov's best-known work takes the form of large installations. Like the man who flew into space from his apartment from the Ten Characters of 1988. And with the first of these realized in 1983 in his Moscow studio, Gavrikov made the experience of his internal dialogue still more real by creating a physical space in which it might take place. Over time, Gavrikov's installations became increasingly immersive, insisting that the viewer step into more and more elaborate and self-contained environments and lose him or herself in the flood of sensation and association. In approaching the work, we need to follow Gavrikov's persevering preoccupation with examining the life of imagination through specificity as a means of transcendence from the body, as it were, of any particular work, and by extension from the material particularity of life itself. Bernard Shaw remarked that decency is indecency, is conspiracy, is silence. Kabakov learned to survive through an internal psychic exile transcended through imagination. But in its public expression, the terms of Kabakov's exile and his escape fundamentally destabilized the language of his confinement. Installations as a medium, of course, inherently critique their own medium specificity. They throw the formal hierarchies into disarray. The details in Kabakov's installations shift attention to the most intimate levels of association and feeling, a well of feeling so full precisely because they too undermine structure with the chaos of daily life. And here, to come back to some of the things that have been said today, you know, Rob's question about where is truth, it seems to me that there is none. And that this is, in a way, an underlying part of Kabakov's work, that we are all in a vortex of kind of colliding fictions, that we are all dreamwalking, in some sense, in a reality that has become so much more detached from the kind of physical sense of reality or nature that we once had. I again want to come back to the staircase, the notion of cleaning up the staircase that Pavel mentioned, that somehow by changing the form of the staircase, it no longer is useful. We may clean it up, but the moment we clean it up, we don't need to go back. And that the form is itself the meaning. And that we've passed, of course, from a verbal culture long ago into a visual culture with collage as an underlying principle for how we reorganize our experience on a daily basis. And it's a very complex and very open-ended redefinition that's dynamic, it's constantly changing. And it's one of the great things that works of art do is they reinstate a kind of healthy sense of ignorance in confrontation with the work of art. So all of this, to my view, gives Kabakov's work a far more profound social and political dimension than a work, for example, that engages the events in the real world in an overt or illustrative manner. They do, in fact, I would say, subvert indecency's conspiracy of silence. Thank you.